This is Christoph Kasun, and you're listening to Navigating Diversity, where we explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. In this special series, Navigating the Big Questions, we shift the entire focus of the conversation away from the reactionary politics and incendiary news of these extraordinary times. Thank you to Doug Chambers for joining us in our last episode to help us navigate some of the deeper questions, the big, sometimes heavy questions, that give all of this and all of our lives meaning. You can catch our conversation at kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity. This week, we are continuing our moral, philosophical, spiritual, whatever you want to call it, conversation, and choosing to focus on the light as the only way to anchor some hope and faith in the future and make some of the darkness disappear. Today, I am joined by Dr. Kurt Anderson, Professor of Comparative Neuroethology at Idaho State University. Hi, Kurt.
It's a joy to be here, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in. I'm really excited for this one. So, you know, I really don't know much about you. You know, let's begin with your story. Where are you from?
I grew up from southern New Mexico, primarily Missouri. Mm-hmm. Lived in the Intermountain West for a while and was fortunate enough to get a job at ISU. And this is how old I am. This is my 24th year at ISU. The first 23 were really normal. And the last one's been very strange.
Very, very strange. Strange times. Probably nothing like you've seen in all your years of being here.
It completely changed how we think about teaching and how we think about thinking.
Share some insights.
It was extremely difficult when we went online for me to not have students in front of me. That social interaction with people was difficult for me. And I think it was difficult for the students, too. And we're in a bizarre transition of having to interact through Zoom or Google Meet or whatever it might be.
Right.
But it's been an interesting challenge on how we think about teaching and how we think about interacting with our fellow humans.
Right. I think it's totally changed the pedagogy game.
It sure has.
So you've been a professor at ISU
Yes. Since
you came. Tell us a little bit about what you study. What do you teach?
So my background is comparative evolutionary neuroanatomy. Primarily, I study the neural control of movement, and I have published on that for, goodness, close to 30 years now. And I have a theory among neurobiologists, which I would like to consider myself one, that eventually you get to the point where you realized you haven't asked the right questions. And I began to really contemplate over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, the idea that what I was doing, I would like to think was important, is important, but I wasn't getting to what I really wanted to know.
So you were almost asking the wrong question.
I'm not sure they were the wrong questions. I'm just not sure they're the right questions. And those aren't necessarily the same answer.
I like it.
And so I began to contemplate other concepts. And I'm not the only one who's done this. You know, Francis Crick, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering DNA, he posthumously published as his last manuscript a theory of consciousness. I think many of us oftentimes end up there. And you're going, yeah, I think there's a lot more that we don't know.
Wow, a theory of consciousness that I think
I know, and that's way beyond my intelligence.
Right, for listeners, I think, even for me, is it possible to come up with a unified theory of all human consciousness?
I think it's impossible. My favorite teaching evaluation of all time was about 3 years ago when a student wrote, "There's so much more about the brain that Kurt just doesn't know." And I thought, boy, are you right. And so I kind of wandered down a slightly different path, and I've changed my research trajectory because of that.
Wow. So what do you study now? What has the shift been?
Well, I switched from what I was doing into investigating the neuroscience of the human cortex, particularly under guided controls, and my initial idea was to focus on increasing academic performance in the classroom by what I call neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity has been accepted for decades, but it's not in most of the textbooks. And it's the idea that, and it's a very simple, it's what I call circuit training for the mind. We go to the gym, we exercise a muscle, it gets bigger.
Right.
We exercise a bone, it gets stronger. Why can't we exercise the brain? Mm. And there's tremendous data out there that we can. And I decided I wanted to know how. And so I've tried to take it from a fairly scientific perspective of trying to explain the growth of the brain. I've got an MRI sitting up on my computer in my office of an 88-year-old female with neurogenesis, new neurons in the brain. They continually grow, but we need to try to figure out a way to do it in the right form that we can teach. I taught a workshop a couple years ago to some graduating seniors at ISU on mindfulness and a few practices. And a bunch of them came up to me and said, why didn't we get this as freshmen? And I said, no problem. So I did. And I taught freshmen. And they said, what are you doing? They didn't quite catch on.
Right.
Then the American Falls School District asked me to teach a workshop for their faculty. And I did. And then I went over there and they said, would you teach another class for us, but to our students? And we can watch you in the classroom. And I emailed them back and I said, sure, what grade? And they said, first.
Wow.
So I walked
in. Mindfulness to first graders.
I walked into 32 first graders and I have never been scared in my life walking into a classroom before. But we had over an hour of mindfulness and it's becoming very, very commonplace in the classroom. I've got emails from a friend of mine in Queensland, Australia that's putting it in. Boulder, Colorado. I've got a friend in downtown Chicago putting this in the classroom. And we know that it works, but my background as an experimental biologist said, I want to know how it works. And that's what I'm studying right now.
You know, I think you make a good point. Mindfulness is becoming more incorporated, particularly into Western education, but it's always been kind of a staple in the East, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, right? When you in schools like in Japan, from very early on, they have mindfulness classes and doing all of these different things. And I feel like the West is now kind of trying to catch up with these things we've kind of known a little bit in other parts of the world.
I couldn't agree more. Somewhere in the late 70s, I think around 1979, a fellow named John Cabot Zinn brought this into the hospitals.
Yep.
And he said, we can help recovery with this. And there is tremendous data. For example, breast cancer survivors have an increased recovery time. And I was asked from one of our health professional programs at ISU year or so ago to teach a course in alternative medicine. And I said, no, I won't do it. But I will teach a course in complementary medicine.
It has to go hand in hand.
Meaning we're not going to say don't take radiation therapy, don't take chemotherapy, don't have surgery, but we can increase survival times. And that is well documented in literature. But what's not well documented is how it works. And that's my approach, is to trying to figure out how it's working.
And how can we explain this and use this in an effective way to improve people's lives? And
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think what John Kabat-Zinn and, you know, even other people like Deepak Chopra and those people have been talking about the mind-body connection. And it's really something in, again, Western society, we've kind of fallen away from how much you can control your physical health by just controlling your mind and taking time to be present and meditate and manifest your healing.
When I first started, I couldn't tell you when I started meditation because one of my favorite forms of mindfulness is what's called walking meditation. I think I've been doing that since I was a little kid. But when I first started the actual practice, because I'm a scientist-oriented human, I hooked myself up to an EKG machine and a blood pressure machine. And within 10 minutes, dropped my blood pressure 40 points and my heart rate 20 beats. And I had an epiphany going, I think we're on to something here. I think we can demonstrate scientifically what's actually happening. I mean, we've all known for whatever, 7,000, 8,000 years, but there's a few of us out there that are trying to approach this from a very scientific perspective.
Right.
And that's the goal of my new research program right now.
And I think that makes it just more accessible, right? When we begin to understand how, you know, spiritual concepts and practices can integrate into our physical, medical health. And I think that's powerful and that's important. So, I'm excited you guys are working on the separate research because it's been way overdue.
Well, the downside of this is we got our first electroencephalography measurements of the human brain on March 12th. I don't have one since. So our research program kind of hit a brick wall for a little while. But we're going to be back and we're going to be there. I'm starting some experiments next week that involve blood pressure and EKGs. And we've got some guided meditations that, and we've put this into clinical practice. I mean, the National PA program had a recorded workshop on guided meditation, and a bunch of students from ISU came back and said, hey, we listened to this guided meditation, and you know what? It sounded kind of a lot like you. Because it was. So I do not consider myself an expert. In fact, my mentors, who are also mentors of my PhD program, my other PhD program, are on campus and have done it a lot longer than I am. But I'm taking it from a really scientific perspective, which very few people have actually done.
So, Kurt, how would you explain in just the simplest way to the average person what meditation is and why, what the benefits are?
That's a beautiful question. So I think we kind of need to define a couple terms here.
Okay.
I'm not a huge fan of the term spirituality because I don't know what it means. If it means we're going outside of our own consciousness and expecting something else, that doesn't work quite so well for me. But if we're defining it as something inside the emergent properties of the human cortex that we can affect, then I buy into that. But I also completely don't like the concept that science and an inner emergent property of consciousness are separate things. I don't know why we can't discuss those at the same time.
Right.
And the idea of mindfulness or meditation or prayer, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't matter. They're all the same.
Exactly.
Can change the brain. And this has been known. Goodness, Donald Hebb published a book in 1949, and he said, his very famous quote was, neurons that wire together, fire together. Meaning if we practice healthy practices of the brain, we can build those strengths in the brain. So if you are practicing healthy thought processes, and one of the really interesting concepts about this is when I talk to folks about this, friends of mine, so you mean you stop thinking? No. The initial data is suggesting that there's certain brain waves called delta and gamma waves that are accelerated under guided mindfulness. And those are focused on concentration. So it's not that you're getting rid of thoughts, you're actually concentrating better. You know, Charles Darwin in his autobiography said he never had a thought without walking, that he wrote most of his papers internally before he got back to his house. That's concentration. It's not mindlessness, it's mindfulness. And those are very, very different things.
Absolutely. It's a meditation. You're concentrating and focusing on this one thing at this one time. And this is what you're putting 100% of your energy into.
The example I gave in one of my meditations that I recorded was, you know, imagine my favorite place, which is this little waterfall that nobody knows about right under a maple tree. And a leaf drops onto that river, that little tiny, it's a little tiny creek, maybe 4 feet across. And that leaf moves down. Well, you've got a thought on that leaf, and then it disappears, so you wait for the next one. Right. You're not focusing on a thought. You're accepting it in the present moment under a guided condition, and then you let it go on, and then you wait for the next one.
And you can let it come without judgment. You appreciate it, and you let it pass again.
You've obviously read Jon Kabat-Zinn.
I have read a little, yes.
And I always end his quote, without judgment, and I always end it with, just like a puppy does.
Oh, beautiful.
So I've changed this quote to add the fourth line, which is, just like a puppy does.
I love it. If you're just joining us, this is Christoph Gesoon, and you're listening to Navigating Diversity. I am here with guest Dr. Kurt Anderson, and we are navigating some of the big questions that help give all of this and all of our lives meaning. So, Kurt, I understand you're getting a second PhD in meditation. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of a, in many ways, ridiculous story. Mm-hmm. So I've had this project in mind for a few years now. And I was tracking down friends that I wanted to help. I needed an expert in electroencephalography. I needed an expert in the practice of mindfulness systems. So I found the right people to help me. And they were willing to help me. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do this for a degree. Why I need a second PhD is beyond me. I have no idea. So I talked to my friends in psychology, which is a tremendous program at ISU.
Oh, yeah.
And it just wasn't the right fit. Talked to my friends in occupational and physical therapy, who are also dear friends, and I've taught in their program for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the right fit. About that time, one of my dear friends, Tony Seichel, who's a retired audiologist at ISU, he and Dan Hadak and Gabriel Bargan started a PhD program in rehabilitation and communication sciences at ISU, brand new PhD program. And I thought, A, they'll get credit for a PhD student, and B, I will lose the guilt of having these people work with me because Dan and Tony were the two people I was going to talk to. So now they have to. So, but it's a beautiful PhD program, and it's wonderful to be in because we've got exercise scientists, audiologists, speech pathologists, weird people like me. It's just this wonderful cohort of people who are interested in big questions.
Ooh.
It's really a graduate program in let's now ask the big questions they all wanted to.
I love it.
I do too. I'm a huge fan of this program. It's been a fascinating journey.
Wow.
It's very strange for me because I get emails from ISU as a full professor, and then I get emails from them as a graduate student, which I'm both right now. But It's really a fascinating program, and I get to interact with people cross-disciplinary. I'm working with some of them, teaching them clinical neuroscience. They're teaching me clinical audiology.
Wow.
So it's like if you got a bunch of friends together that just self-educated themselves. It's a beautiful PhD program at ISU.
Sounds like a powerful cohort.
It is a powerful cohort, and it's literally barely a year old now. So I think it's gonna catch steam when people. I call it integrative thinking. That's how I think about that program. Let's stop and ask the big questions.
Right, right. We know what we know. Now let's ask why. Why do we think we know it?
Yes.
So, how has meditation and mindfulness practices help you succeed in terms of school and being able to focus and being able to study and these kinds of things? Because I don't quite get the sense that people, particularly my age, understand how much it can help you in being successful in life.
I did a research project last year. I had 30 of my human anatomy and physiology students. We were doing EMG and EKGs and EEGs and all that sort of fancy E words, right? And to test the equipment, I hooked them up for 5 minutes. And we just found online some random guided meditation. We just pulled one off the web. And I had them watch on the computer their blood pressures and EKGs. And they all walked out of that classroom totally flipped out. And then I did a workshop. It was completely voluntary. And so there's no statistical significance, complete confirmation bias. It would never pass muster because there was no controlled study. But I offered a optional course through the physician assistant program. Through their good graces, they welcomed it. You didn't have to come. You were welcome to come. I did it every week for a full semester. Out of all of the students in the program, 9 of the top 10 went through this workshop.
Wow.
Now, is that confirmation bias? I'm absolutely convinced it is. It's not statistical. There was no control group.
Right.
But nonetheless,
it suggests something.
It made me realize we're on to something.
Mm.
And I've already heard from some second grade teachers from American Falls who I taught their first grade teacher, or their first grade students last year, going, we haven't stopped doing this yet.
Mm.
So I don't have the real data to demonstrate a controlled study of increasing academic performance, but I think it's coming.
Hmm.
I think we're on to something. It's hard to convince a freshman in college coming in that it's useful.
Right.
It's easy, as I've shown already, to convince a senior going, shoot, I wish I had done that as a freshman.
Right, because they've been through the ringer. Like, they've been crazy busy for years at that point, right? When they're a little bit older, they're in grad school, they're in their full-time positions.
I have a 7-year-old daughter who has been practicing meditation since she was 3.
Ooh.
And even last night, she said, I put her to bed, and she said, Daddy, is it time for our meditations?
Wow. You see, this is cool, because how often do people pray with their children, right? Everybody's always like, pray with your children before bed. Well, meditate is the same thing.
It's the same function. We think it occurs exactly the same way. Now, I tend to teach a very secular approach, but it's the same thing. Little Sophia says, Daddy, can we meditate before bed?
Wow.
And so instead of saying our prayers, I'll meditate, or I'll pull out my Tibetan singing bowl and play for 3 minutes for her.
And she loves it.
And she, it's, to her, it's just how one relaxes.
Wow. So this might be a bit of a tricky question, but you said she started at 3 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
What change did you see in her growth and personality pre and post? And I know that's hard, right?
But well, that is a trick question because I don't have a control group.
Of course, right? Again. But your sense, just from your experience of having raised her in this way, what have you seen?
She is a very, very caring human being.
Mm.
And she respects other people's kindness. Now, does that mean she wouldn't have without it? Who knows? I'm not going to do that control experiment with my children.
Of course.
But she's a very kind, caring human being who just loves human beings. And I think part of it is because of the kindness that we can get. And that's a very, very important part of guided mindfulness. And it's not just kindness for others. One of the hardest parts that I discovered was self-compassion, a kindness for yourself. And the kindness for others, for me, was easy.
Right.
Kindness for myself was a little bit harder. And I work with that regularly because, you know, it's I can be very kind to you, but sometimes I'm not kind to me. But she is very, very kind to others, and that brings me joy. And I'd like to contribute that to mindfulness, but I'm not going to stop doing it because I don't want to know if I'm right. I'm going to keep doing what we're doing.
Exactly.
And that approach, I've got a friend of mine I mentioned in Queensland, Australia. She started her kids in first grade just like I did with American Falls, and they've started in their first grade. And it's going into school systems all across the world right now.
Wow, and it's going to make a big shift, I think, in the next coming years.
We won't really know this, except the reality of it is, A, it's free. It's not difficult to do.
Anybody can do it.
Anybody can do
mindful.
It. I have taught workshops to as old as 85, and I'm on a discussion group with friends of mine who are teaching it in preschool, believe it or not. Now, when I went and did it with first graders, I didn't use fancy words like attention to breath or inhalation or exhalation or control your diaphragm. No, I had them lay down on the floor and balance their favorite stuffed animal on their chest and said, let's watch it rise to a count of three. Ooh. And then drop to a count of three. And then I had them balance feathers on their nose and say, blow it out and exhale until it hits the ground. I didn't use any fancy scientific words.
You don't need a...
But the kids were doing it. Mm. And it blew my mind that it's really, really easy to teach.
Hmm.
When I go to the Port of Sangha here in town, which I haven't physically been to since March, we all Zoom our Sunday meditation.
Uh-huh.
The age range is literally 6 to probably 90.
Wow, that's beautiful.
And it's kind of nice to see that we're getting a resurgence of younger folks. And I created guidelines, all the curriculum, everything for an ISU mindfulness club.
Hmm.
It's all written, but obviously...
With everything going
on. Things got weird fast. So if you have any students interested, I wrote the core curriculum, the constitution, everything, just that I need students.
Right, students have to run the club, yes.
Yeah,
so there's anybody listening out there, an ISU student that is interested.
Get hold of me,
yes.
Because we're ready to rock and roll. And I've been teaching it across campus. And I'm not the only one. What's really cool about ISU is I think there were 6 courses this semester alone offered through various health professional programs, the Counseling and Testing Center,
mm-hmm.
which is right around the corner here somewhere, on mindfulness for students. And right now, what I see in my students is a stress level that I haven't seen in a quarter of a decade or a quarter of a century, literally.
Wow.
The students are running a little bit nervous.
Yeah. So now more than ever, I think it's beneficial for us to take moments to be mindful.
This is exactly the right time. And if students want to get involved, go to the ISU catalog, look up courses, or just email me. Go to the biology department website. It's not hard to find the weird bald guy. I'm right at the top of the page. And drop me an email, and I would love to get in touch with you, and I would love to get this
off the ground.
Informal or formal program started.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it with individual programs, but...
We need a structure. We need an institution for this stuff, too. At some point, you kind of have to plan and organize it and get it done.
Yeah. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was tasked to create an integrative neuroscience program. And I had it figured out that it would cover 6 different departments on campus, from pharmacy to psychology to
wow.
occupational therapy, physical therapy, PA, biology, et cetera, et cetera. And then, as anybody who knows, that the budget kind of went weird, and that paperwork is still sitting there. And this would be a part of it
mm-hmm.
if we were to create that program.
Absolutely.
So one of these days, I'm hoping so, but it's not going to be this year.
Right, given everything. So, Kurt, do you have any last little bits of advice for anybody listening on how they can, work to be more mindful or maybe see this in a different light?
The one piece of advice I would suggest is very personal to me, and that is anybody can do it.
Mm.
I fought this for a long time because I was diagnosed with severe ADHD. And I thought, no, there's absolutely no way I could do this. And suddenly I realized it's the greatest pharmaceutical that's free and you're not taking drugs.
There you guys have it.
And anybody can do this. I taught a workshop at the Edson Fichter Nature Center last summer. The youngest was 5, my daughter.
Mm.
The oldest was 85, my mother. And I taught a continuing education program this summer. And most of the people that attended that workshop last summer teach in School District 25 and are getting continuing education credit from me. I haven't given them the grades yet. So if you're listening, sorry, guys, I'll get that fixed. And they're putting it into the classroom. Anybody can do this. And it doesn't matter, secular, religious. It crosses all boundaries. And if you wanted to ask a free way to drop your blood pressure and feel better about yourself, come on, guys.
Right.
This is a free pass.
You don't need to let yourself go into the panic attack spiral every time. You could take 2 minutes and actually take back control of your heart rate and your breathing and your body and your mind.
But you still will go into those panic attacks, but you can get back out of them.
A little bit quicker.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Kurt, for being here.
This has been a joy for me.
I would love to have you back on sometime.
Please do so.
Absolutely.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing. It means a lot to my generation, I can tell you that.
Bless you.
This is Christoph Kassoun, and you've been listening to Navigating Diversity. Dr. Kurt Anderson and I have been navigating some of the big questions that help give all of this and all of our lives meaning. Join us next week at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday as we continue to explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. For more information on all episodes, visit kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity.